Welcome to Worldly on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Zach Beecham, a senior reporter at Vox, along with foreign editor Jennifer Williams. Alex Ward is enjoying a well-deserved vacation this week, but in his place, we've got a special guest, Matt Iglesias, Vox co-founder and host of our sister podcast, The Weeds.
Hi!
Hello to both of you and Jen.
Hello also, and welcome to Matt.
Well, we're especially glad to have Matt this week because he knows a lot about economics, and today's topic is the rolling economic collapse of Turkey. So Turkey's a NATO ally and one of the most important countries in the Middle East. Its currency, the lira, is in free fall. It's a bad situation made worse by a recent feud with the Trump administration. The feud started with an American pastor held in Turkish prison, and it's led Trump to impose tariffs on Turkey's steel and aluminum sectors. Experts are now warning of an even worse economic crisis on the horizon. So here's how TV personality Jim Cramer puts it in his own inimitable way.
Don't buy anything that can possibly be connected to Turkey.
Don't buy, which would be good for the Bluth Company, but not so much for Turkey. But all right, Matt, let's start us off. What's going on here?
Okay, so anytime you see an emerging market debt crisis like this, there's always particulars. Erdogan has some wacky particulars that we'll get into, but the general phenomenon is basically always the same. All emerging market debt crises are the same. The old joke among traders is in a crash like this, it's not the speed that kills you, it's the sudden stop. And the way it works is that something happens, some kind of political change in a country. And for whatever reason, that change makes the foreign investment community more optimistic about that company's prospects. So foreigners start putting money into the country. They start investing, usually through some kind of intermediaries, right? They don't necessarily have projects of their own, but they're lending money to banks. Then because people are investing a lot in the country in fact does well. So that seems to validate the optimism. So more investors come in, so more projects go.
It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly.
Right.
And as long as that cycle of optimism is going, it self-fulfills, right? So whether or not it's true that the underlying changes are all that awesome, you keep growing, you keep growing. But then, like Wile E. Coyote running off the cliff, something else changes, usually a political development in that country or sometimes abroad, that makes people reevaluate. And you say, oh, wait a minute, this country's not so good. And the money comes out. And then the whole process goes into reverse. It goes into reverse very quickly. The value of the currency falls down. And then it turns out that lots of people have loans that were depending on the value of the currency staying high. So they're going bankrupt. One thing leads to another. The government's in crisis. And it's really hard to deal with.
So sub in a few nouns, and that's what's going on with Turkey. But
right.
Like to understand how we got to the sudden stop, as Matt said, you need to understand some political changes that have happened in Turkey. So Jen, why don't you go back in time a little bit?
Right. So let's go back to, you know, why everyone started investing in Turkey in the first place, right? There's some really important political context here. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, he was prime minister. He had run the government for a while. In 2014, he decides to run for president. And his campaign, his entire kind of platform, besides kind of smaller things like increasing social welfare, was we are going to bring Turkey to one of the top 10 economies in the world. We are going to advance democracy. We're going to normalize politics and society. We're going to improve social welfare, other things like that. We're going to work towards a new constitution. We're going to achieve higher democratic standards. And we're going to basically normalize the country, make it a safe, kind of reliable place for people to invest. And people really signed on and they started investing.
They did.
And it was, you know, it was discussed at the time, like, is this going to work? But he got enough believers to make it work. And as he started consolidating power, I mean, I think there were visible warning signs, right, that the political changes were maybe not all in the direction of enduring stability.
Right.
No.
So the problem is that, like, as he does this thing, he's basically transitioning from a parliamentary system to a presidential system, right? Because he's not the prime minister anymore. He's the president. So he's like, okay, I'm going to consolidate power all in the hands of the presidency. Me, my person, myself. And he starts doing some things that are very disturbing and authoritarian.
Right. Well, they're not just these separation of powers things in terms of changing who controlled the government. It was also things like repressing mass demonstration against his rule, seizing control of newspapers and curtailing the space for independent media. It involved, after a coup attempt
right.
in 2015.
Then you have the coup in attempt right. in 2015, which was huge.
And the coup attempt was a response to all this undemocratic stuff.
Right.
Right, that Erdogan was doing. Right. Some people in the military were like, we're really concerned about the state of Turkish democracy.
Which is the thing they do in Turkey.
Yeah, it's an odd long history we won't get into here. But that led Erdogan to go even more in the direction of I'm going to be an authoritarian and purge the civil service.
Like massively.
Yeah.
Like tens of thousands of people were like kicked out. Thousands were thrown in jail.
And I should say in economic terms, you know, authoritarian countries can do fine.
Right.
But part of the effort to consolidate this regime was purging the civil service, which is relevant now because it has deprived the state of sort of expertise, right?
So, for instance, the central banker is Erdogan's, I believe, what is it, his son-in-law?
His son-in-law is the finance minister. And Turkey doesn't have a central bank that's like separate in the way that some other countries do, right? It's the finance minister, and because it's the son-in-law, by proxy, Erdogan controls the economy on top of controlling the government.
And then they started doing something that a lot of countries do while they're benefiting from capital inflows is that it's cheap for the government to borrow money as well as the private sector.
Right.
So you can sort of do your big projects, right? And of course, if you do great projects, like this can be a huge boost to your economy.
Right.
But if you select bad projects, which I believe he has, you know, you lay this groundwork for some trouble.
Right. So currently they're building the world's largest airport for reasons that are unclear to me. It's not like Turkey really needs more airports. They already have a rather nice airport near Istanbul and lots of other ones. Like this is just a pointless project. There's a bridge in Istanbul that they built that was supposed to pay for itself with toll money, but nobody actually uses it. It's just a vanity project.
World's biggest of anything is always sort of like a red flag. Right?
Yeah, it's like that's what authoritarian dictators do.
Well, it's also, it's like, Turkey is not the biggest country in the world. Some place should have the world's biggest airport, right? But like, why should it be your country?
No, it should be like a large city with like the world's largest population. You would think that would be the place that needs the biggest airport. But this is not that. This is purely a monument to Erdogan that doesn't have his face on it. I mean, it might have his face on it when they're done. I don't know.
So you have kind of all of this erratic behavior from Erdogan, right? You have massive inflating debt. You have these big vanity projects. You have this purge of the civil service. And everyone suddenly stops believing that maybe investment in Turkey is the best idea. And that's the sudden stop, right, that Matt was explaining.
So investments come out. The value of the currency starts to fall because investors are coming out. And the Jim Cramer psychology, right, takes over, which is important, right? Don't buy anything that's connected in any way to Turkey, right? And that's in part because he's like a weird guy who's on television, but it's but it's real investment advice, right? So the value of the currency is falling so fast that from a foreigner's viewpoint, even a perfectly good company that is making money, it's making lira. But the lira are becoming less and less valuable. So you don't want to invest in anything that has anything to do with Turkey. But that makes it impossible for any Turkish business to do anything, right? It's like, you know, when you're in the upswing, even bad business ventures work out because of the self-fulfilling prophecy. But when you're in the downswing, it's the opposite. And even a totally normal, well-run company gets screwed.
And Jen, this has real consequences for people living in Turkey, right? Like this isn't just an abstract international investment thing.
Right, exactly. It becomes the hardest for the most vulnerable people in Turkey. And a lot of the most vulnerable people in Turkey are actually Syrian refugees. Because reminder, Syria is right on the border with Turkey. And there has been a massive, horrific, bloody civil war that has become an international proxy war that's right across the border. Turkey is partially involved. But Turkey has a massive population of Syrian refugees who fled over the border. And so the Washington Post had a really great piece, Karim Fahim. He interviewed this guy, Ahmed Khalif, who is a Syrian refugee. He's a day laborer in Turkey. And he was saying that he had watched inflation basically eat away at the $150 he had put away every month to send back to relatives at home. The lira's falling, prices of food, shampoo, utilities, like basic things are falling. And what he had scraped together was now barely enough for him to even survive on, let alone sending money to relatives back in Syria. There's also a great interview with a guy who's in Istanbul's Grand Bazaar, you know, the big market where they sell carpets and rugs and spices and basically everything you could ever want. He had retired and the climbing prices had to bring him back out of retirement. So now he's this like old man who's trying to take a few extra shifts at a shop in the Grand Bazaar because the economy is so bad right now.
So you know, this is not, again, just to underscore what Jen is saying, like, while it's important from an international stability, geopolitics, global economy way, the people who are most impacted are these ordinary Turkish people. Now, other countries have been in similar positions, as Matt was describing earlier, but eventually these developing markets tend to pull themselves out of the nosedive, or they can, right?
Sometimes.
All right. In the good cases. So what do they do in the good cases? And is that like, well, let's start with the good cases. Then we'll talk about whether or not it's plausible in Turkey.
Sure. So, I mean, there's basically two things you can do to get out of the sudden stop. There's like the populist strategy, most recently seen by the Kirchners in Argentina. And that's basically you impose capital controls, right? So you say like, Turkish people can't buy foreign currency anymore. You default on your external debts. You kind of cut yourself off from the global financial system and sail away. And this has some upsides. But the official internationally approved thing to do that the business community would like Erdogan to do is to raise interest rates
right.
domestically. And that will make Turkish government bonds attractive to foreign investors again, that will stabilize the currency, put a floor, hopefully, under the economic collapse. It's going to come at the cost of really clamping down on construction activity in Turkey, which there's a lot of big Turkish construction companies that are close to the ruling regime. And also, I mean, people will lose their jobs if you curtail construction activity. So that's a tough choice. Governments in this situation tend to not want to make that choice if they can avoid it. And Erdogan personally has some, I would say, unusual views about interest rates.
Yeah, right. His view, and this is just baffling to me, is that, and the exact quote, I believe, is high interest rates are the mother of all evil or something like that. And he seems to think that inflation is caused by high interest rates rather than the other way around, which is what all economists think. And this is why it's really problematic to have his son-in-law in the finance ministry.
Right, because they need to raise interest rates to turn this ship around. And that's why, you know, having a more independent central bank is really important, because they can make the tough decisions that politically are not popular, and also that maybe the politician himself doesn't actually want to do. But if the person in charge of making those decisions is your son-in-law, I mean, unless he's a really brave guy, and I'm guessing he's probably not when Erdogan is like imprisoned thousands of political prisoners and opponents, he's not going to do something against what Erdogan's wishes. So you're not going to raise interest rates. And Erdogan is partially doing the other thing that you talked about, the other piece of that, Matt. So earlier this week, I think Erdogan and Putin had a conversation, Vladimir Putin of Russia, and they're talking about like, look, what if we just had like a one-on-one kind of deal where we only trade in lira and rubles and we just kick the US dollar out of it? So again, talking about that kind of like, we will clamp down, we will only operate in our currency, we will cut ourselves off from like a global economic market. But nobody really thinks that that's a good idea.
Yeah, to connect yourself to a country that's under heavy Western sanctions and that's the one that you want to, you know, do financial transactions with, it seems not wise.
Well, and also, I mean, you really should emphasize, like, there's no good solutions to these problems. Like, what you really have to try to do is not get in the situation in the first place. And typically, it's just, it's so difficult for a regime that was responsible for the problem in the first place to make any kind of tough calls, right? Because if a new government comes in, like in a democracy, you can say like, oh, my predecessor really screwed things up, so here's like the steps we're going to take to turn around. But like, what's Erdogan and his son-in-law going to say, right? You can be like, oh, we're idiots. Our monetary policy has been driven by a crazy conspiracy theory for the past 3 years.
Oopsie, we were wrong.
Right. Yeah. So it's, I mean, so nobody does that, right? So it seems unlikely that they are going to pivot this successfully.
The other thing is that the legitimacy of the AKP, which is the name of Erdogan's party.
AKP, if you're just looking at it English.
For our English-speaking listeners.
Yeah, for the few that don't speak Turkish in our audience.
Huge Turkish contingent in our
how is your Turkish?
Look, his whole argument for a long time has been being able to deliver economic growth. And as Matt was saying, if you raise interest rates, growth slows down, right? And then the people who've been backing Erdogan for a long time, the people he depends on to win re-election in his pseudo-democratic system, they get really mad. And this imperils the stability of the regime. And so from his point of view, he would rather suffer extended inflation crises that imperil his government and his support base and alienate those people. And in the midst of all of this, the United States decides to involve itself.
Right. So you have this fight. Andrew Brunson is this Christian evangelical pastor who's lived in Turkey for, I think, at least a decade, if not longer. And he was essentially caught up in this massive purge that we talked about earlier. Erdogan went a little nutty when the attempted coup happened and blamed the coup on a whole host of people, including people from American think tanks, people in the U.S. military, all sorts of people in the civil service, pretty much anyone he felt like he wanted to maybe be mad at or get rid of. Andrew Brunson, this pastor, was included in that and so was imprisoned. This is something that Vice President Mike Pence in particular is very concerned about and has pushed the Trump administration to push Turkey to release Andrew Brunson. They refused. They did let him out on house arrest, but they refused to let him go. And so Trump decided to punish Turkey by applying these tariffs that we talked about at the top on their steel industry. It's basically a lot of people looked at it like kicking Turkey while it was down. In some ways, yes, fighting to get an American citizen out of prison, and especially the fact that a U.S. NATO ally has imprisoned an American and is refusing to give them back. That's the kind of thing we see from North Korea or Iran. That's not the kind of thing you expect from your literal treaty ally. So it's reasonable to want to do something to push them, right? But Trump tweets about that he's going to maybe apply tariffs. The lira just plummets even further. So it was just on top of this horrible crisis, you now have this acute kind of crisis point that just made everything just go insane.
Right. I want to be clear, Matt, right? This isn't the cause of Turkey's economic woes. The cause is all the other stuff we've been talking about. Trump just made a bad situation worse.
Yeah, and he created a trigger, right? I mean, so much of this market dynamics are psychological, right? And so it's like, getting in the news because you're at some fight with the president of the United States, that's like a good time for everyone to like rethink Turkey. And you see like, oh my God, this is not so good.
So Zach, what you were saying earlier about how, you know, Erdogan is mostly concerned about his political base, right? And maintaining his political power. So in a weird way, this is actually seems to have helped him because now he can say, look, here's what's actually wrong with our economy. It's nothing wrong with our economy and what I'm doing. It's Trump. It's that guy. Trump and the Americans are attacking us. And it kind of creates this like rally around the flag effect where everyone's like, oh, yeah, there's an external power fighting us. And like we need to all stick together and support Erdogan and fight back because how dare you attack Turkey? Now, it's not to say that everyone in Turkey is that naive to think this is going on. But, you know, we see it in countries all over the place, including in America. This is a real kind of, again, psychological dynamic. Like, as soon as someone else starts attacking you, you kind of just, okay, it's time to stick up for our leadership and for our country. So in a perverse way, it's actually, at least so far, maybe emboldened Erdogan to continue even further doing what he's doing.
And on that note, we'll end this discussion of what some observers have termed America's worst ally and its economic woes. Perhaps we'll discuss why it's such a bad ally in the future. But I want to thank Matt for showing up today. He's not going to stick with us through elsewhere, but Jen and I will be talking about Pirates of the Caribbean, not the movie, real ones that actually exist right now. Debt. Some have a lot. Some have a little, and the vast majority of us, including me, have some.
Me too.
But that path to financial freedom can look awfully bleak when you have high interest debt. And if your FICO score isn't great, it can make breaking out of that revolving debt cycle harder than it should be. Thankfully, our sponsor Upstart is changing the way that you get money and that you borrow it.
Woo, so, I like money.
I bet you do. Upstart offers personal loans, but they're not like the ones that your bank or credit union provide. Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score in assessing your creditworthiness. They actually reward you based on your education or your job history in the form of a smarter interest rate.
Finally, something pays off for that education I got.
Yeah, and the student loans. 2 minutes is all it takes to go online and find your Upstart rate. Checking your Upstart rate is always free and it won't affect your credit. And the best part, once your loan is approved, the funds will be transferred to you the very next business day.
The very next business day.
Over 100,000 people have purchased Upstart to pay off credit cards, fund their wedding, which since I'm paying for mine right now, I know you need to borrow some for, or simply make a large purchase.
I definitely like to make large purchases.
And now it's your turn. Hurry to upstart.com/worldly to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes 2 minutes and it won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/worldly. Disclaimer, loans made by Cross River Bank and FDIC Insured New Jersey State Chartered Commercial Bank. Restrictions apply. Details at upstart.com/worldly. Again, check out Upstart.com/worldly.
What was that, Zach?
Upstart.com/worldly.
Upstart.com/worldly. This week, Explained, Vox's show on Netflix, talks about why we die of old age. And then it asks the question, can we live forever? It shows just how long humans have lived throughout our history and how we brought that number up. It explains that the human lifespan is 120 years, but most of us, even in developed countries, only make it two-thirds of the way there. And it walks through some of the ways we might use medicine to treat our most human of conditions. So go check it out on Netflix. You can search for Explained or for Vox, or you can just go to netflix.com/explained.
Welcome back. So now we're going to talk about something that may sound totally absurd, but it's real. There are actual pirates in the Caribbean Sea right now. So this may sound funny, and you know, it's easy to laugh at it, and we've done that too, but it's also really important and serious.
Right. It's the worst sequel to Pirates of the Caribbean. It's Pirates of the Caribbean Venezuela edition.
Right.
And it's actually really grim. You know, we've talked about this on the show before, but Venezuela is in the midst of a massive, horrific economic, political, and social collapse. But the economic issue in particular, the country's kind of entire economy has collapsed. Inflation is through the roof, numbers that sound insane.
Everything we were talking about in Turkey, which is all very bad, pales in comparison to what's going on in Venezuela, where people can't afford basic goods.
Right.
And people are, there are disease outbreaks.
Mothers are dropping off their infants at the hospital just so they are hoping someone will feed the baby. Like, that's how horrific this is. So you have a massive refugee crisis now. People are fleeing Venezuela. And you also have a very specific piece of this economic crisis, which is the collapse of the fishing industry. So massive fishing companies have gone into bankruptcy, have collapsed. The actual, like, fishing haul has just fallen, like, 60%. So you have all these fishermen who that's what they survived on. That's how they made a living. That's how they fed their families. Now have no way to feed themselves. They have no industry. They have no jobs. And at the same time, you have this massive crisis in Venezuela where people can't get basic goods. So all of a sudden, people are becoming pirates. These fishermen are taking their boats and they're going and smuggling goods back and forth to Trinidad, which is just like 10 miles away from Venezuela. I mean, they're smuggling everything from diapers to guns to medicine, food, humans, like trafficking women, things like that.
The Washington Post had an incredible piece on this where they talked to a crew near Trinidad and an actual fear that people in that region are dealing with, people who work in there on the waters. They have to be concerned about someone going and trying to steal their stuff at gunpoint in a way that we haven't seen in those waters in a really long time.
Right. And it gets even worse. It's not even just like fishermen and like regular people. According to this really great piece in Bloomberg, Business Week, it's actually the Venezuelan Coast Guard and National Guard who are involved in the piracy. Like, they are literally boarding boats, taking motors, stealing the food. You know, these are the actual government people, right? Like, these are the security services who are meant to, you know, do things like fight piracy and fight crime, who are boarding boats. And now you have this problem where, like, ships that are coming to dock in Venezuela are now trying to dock farther and farther away, or just deciding, screw it, we're not going to Venezuela. You also, reminder, the Caribbean is like a huge cruise ship area, right? So there's a big fear, like, that could actually end up crippling, like, a huge part of the economy for dozens of countries in this area who rely on tourism from, like, rich tourists getting on these cruise ships. If the cruise ships start deciding, well, it's too dangerous, we're going to go to different routes, that could have massive ripple effects beyond just Venezuela.
I want to note that the Caribbean is not the only region that in recent years has seen an upswing in piracy. You saw a similar thing a few years back. It's quieted down significantly, but you saw it in Somalia, where there were pirates who would operate on the coast there, and they were a major hazard for shipping, particularly shipping in that area, for a long time until there was a concerted effort to stamp out the pirates in that region. But it took like a major international mobilization to deal with
them. And a movie
them.
Starring Tom Hanks.
Oh, yes. There's also that
also
movie.
That.
And also that movie.
But it was a similar dynamic, right?
Yeah. Somalia is functionally a failed state, or at least it was at that time.
It's not doing great now.
No, it's not. And in the absence of functional governance, what you get are people returning to different forms of political and social organization, things that they can do to protect themselves, given that there's no institution or organization out there fending for their interests and allowing them to survive. And some of those are illegal or dangerous or violent, but it reminds you why we have large government apparatuses that do all of these things for us in the first place, and what happens when through policy, war, natural disaster, or any sort of other crisis, what happens when these institutions collapse.
Right. To get away from like the wonky political science terms for a second, you got to fucking do what you got to do to survive, right? Like at the end of the day, I got to feed my family. I don't have a family. I have a dog, but
Mo needs food too.
Mo needs food and it's expensive. And so, you know, at the end of the day, like if there's no way to go to your good job, to go to the fishing industry, to go, you know, to the oil company where you work, you know, in the oil fields, you have to figure out a way to survive, to get diapers for your children. And so people will turn to extremes. And yes, it's dangerous and it's bad and it's evil in some perspectives, right? But you can also look at it like, well, people need to survive, right? Like, what would you do if you couldn't get infant formula for your baby? That's one of the biggest things that's being smuggled in and out of Venezuela on these smuggling boats to and from Trinidad is infant formula. Would you say, oh no, piracy is evil? Or would you go, you know, my baby's starving, I need to feed it? And yeah, piracy starts to look a lot more attractive if your child is starving.
While that's correct, this is not to morally excuse piracy or let alone human trafficking or any of the other things that are going right on there. Like, it's all bad. It's not something that you want people to be doing or think could be justifiable. It is an understandable response to deprivation and to the collapse of society.
Right. Trafficking in young women or women of any kind who, you know, can't fend for themselves because you could make a quick buck in a collapsing economy is not the correct thing to do, regardless.
Anyway, on that profoundly depressing note, we will leave you. And we want to say thank you to our producer, Bird Pinkerton, our producer, Jillian Weinberger, our social media maven, Julie Bogan, and encourage you to rate, subscribe, review on Apple, Stitcher, SoundCloud, all of the various different podcast thingies. You go on and you rate us and review us. And that's it for this week.
We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.